big color, bigger savings. Sherwin-Williams Super Sale is here. Get 40% off paints and stains June 5th through the 11th with prices starting at $30.89. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
He has desensitized people to very bad behavior.
Welcome to a special edition of Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by The Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. I'm Eric Edelman, counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, non-resident fellow at the Miller Center, and a Bulwark contributor. And I'm joined by my partner in all things strategery, tanned, rested, and ready after a two-week holiday hiatus, Elliot Cohen, professor emeritus of strategy at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and an Atlantic contributor. Elliot, how was your break?
The break was good. We were able to dodge all of our children, grandchildren keeling over one after another with some ghastly stomach crud. But other than that, it was so we missed spending a little bit of time with them. But other than that, it was delightful because we just sat at home and had good food and read good books. What about you?
Same, man. We had a wonderful time at the down at our place on the Eastern Shore. We were down there for 11 days until my phone started blowing up on, you know, Saturday morning. It was very restful.
Yeah, well, I caught the same thing Saturday night. I think before we plunge in, because this is a special edition on the what some people have called the Fracas and Caracas, I do want to acknowledge we're taping this on January 6th. It was 5 years ago that Donald Trump, I think it's fair to say, ignited at least a murderous riot on Capitol Hill. 140 police officers hurt. And to its eternal shame, Congress has still not put up a plaque honoring their sacrifice. And that's shameful, but it's not the only shameful thing one can pin on this Congress.
Equally shameful was the House Oversight Committee's release of Jack Smith's deposition and testimony, including on his investigation of January 6th and the president's role in it, dropping it, you know, essentially on New Year's weekend when nobody, you know, was paying attention, hoping that it would be buried in the mists of time. And certainly sounds like the Republicans on the Oversight Committee, including Jim Jordan and Chairman Comer, kind of misunderestimated how it would go with former special prosecutor Jack Smith, who I think from what I've read of the transcript, I haven't read the whole thing, but
he acquitted himself well.
I thought he handled himself enormously well. You know, we normally start out with the jackassery of the week, and we have been off on a break for a while, but you know, as serious as this Venezuela thing is, they've still found ways to, you know, make jackasses out of themselves. And not the least is the president's somewhat shocking comments about Maria Corina Machado, the Nobel Peace Prize laureate, who he denigrated in his comments on Saturday when he was giving his press conference at Mar-a-Lago about the raid that kidnapped Maduro from Caracas, saying she didn't have the
respect,
you know, or the popularity to govern Venezuela. You and I'll get into some reasons why it might be difficult for her to immediately govern Venezuela. That's a legitimate argument. But the Washington Post reported that, according to, or maybe it was Politico, I can't remember now, I've read so much of the reporting, but the reporting suggests that, according to people close to the White House, the problem really was that Machado had won the Nobel Peace Prize, which Trump wanted. And even though she publicly dedicated it to him, that wasn't enough. If this person suggested she had, you know, given it to Trump herself and said, here, you get my Nobel Prize, she would be president of Venezuela right now, which it suggests a smallness of character, which we've all come to expect, but very revealing nonetheless.
Well, that'll lead to a question which we'll talk about further on, and we'll have Lord knows we'll have enough jackassery to talk about in our regularly scheduled podcast. But I do think we should begin with the operation. First thing, I think one thing one has to say up front is it was extremely well executed. I mean, this was a big, complicated operation, 150 aircraft against some air defenses. There were cyber attacks. They seem to have shut down the lights in Caracas.
Also, some kinetic attacks on the electrical infrastructure. It wasn't just cyber.
Yeah. So, one point that you and I, think very much agree on is that despite the fig leaf, and it's a rather tremulous and transparent fig leaf, of this being a law enforcement operation, this was a military operation. You don't have an operation. And by the way, one of the ways which I think is just really important to remind people of, okay, we killed a lot of people. One number that's out there is 80. The Cubans have said 32 of their intelligence and military personnel were killed. The United States military has gotten very coy about talking about enemy casualties. Now, that's partly after Vietnam. One of the pernicious, where that you had the body count and so forth, and I understand that. One of the pernicious things, though, about that and about a refusal to say, yeah, this is what we think enemy casualties were, is it kind of conceals or smooths over the fact you are engaged in war. You are killing people who are potential combatants. You're probably killing some people who are not combatants because that just happens. And so this was a warlike act, even if it is nominally legal. And I'm sure they have some extremely expensive Yale lawyers who will say that, yes, this was a law enforcement operation. But I think it's very important, I think, to put that one, set that one aside from the very beginning. This was a military action. And I guess one of the things, if you listen to or read the transcript of the press conference that Trump and Hegseth gave, there was an enormous amount of chest beating about the United States military. They weren't praising the courageous DEA agents or, Coast Guardsmen on duty. They understood full well what they were doing.
Big color, bigger savings. Sherwin-Williams Super Sale is here. Get 40% off paints and stains June 5th through the 11th with prices starting at $30.89. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Well, and it was the Delta Force guys who, executed the raid, who took down most of these Cuban security. I mean, the fact that 32 Cuban military and security folks were killed does beg the question of what they were doing there. And of course, as we know, as had been suspected for a long time, a lot of them apparently were providing the personal security for Nicolas Maduro, which is why they were immediately in the line of fire.
Right. Well, I think, look, it's very important for the two of us to stipulate that first, Maduro was a really bad guy. Part of his badness, in addition to being a tyrant and, presiding over a brutal, tyrannical regime, was he was deeply in it with the Cubans. There are various estimates of how many Cuban advisors have been there, several thousand. I've seen numbers as high as 30,000.
Right.
Military, the intelligence system is pervaded by the Cubans, but there's also
secret police.
There's also Hezbollah there, and there's also Iran there. So
the Russians. I mean, there are Wagner guys all over the place.
Right. And in fact, a Wagner airplane, I think, came in October, presumably with weapons. So these are bad guys. Maduro, a particularly bad guy. And that, again, I think we want to stipulate that up front.
Yeah, although, I mean, I'm happy to agree with everything you just said in describing Maduro. And I don't, you know, I'm not shedding any tears for him. He now gets to defend himself. And he was under indictment in the Southern District of New York. He now gets to defend himself in a court of law, if he can, against all of these charges. But I am a little troubled by the legal rationalizations that you're using. I mean, in part because they play it both ways. On the one hand, you know, Marco Rubio goes on the television shows on Sunday and says it was a law enforcement operation. And then last night, you know, Stephen Miller, the deputy chief of staff, is on saying, this is an ongoing military operation. I mean, the president has said we're prepared to launch a second military strike, which would not have anything to do with law enforcement, presumably. So, you know, you can't, number one, have it both ways. Number two, the justification, in as much as they've been willing to provide one, and it's sort of disturbing that it sort of is like a tooth extraction exercise to get it out of them, is to rely on the Noriega operation in 1989-90 under Bush 41. You know, I happen to have a little bit of personal experience with that because I was the acting chief of staff to the acting secretary of state when a lot of this went down in December of 89 and January of 1990. And, you know, my recollection is that it was quite a different, you know, kind of different justification that we used when we launched the operation in Panama. And that was one where Noriega, I mean, there'd been a long buildup to this. There'd also been a lot of public discussion about this and about whether the United States could go after Noriega. Noriega had actually, at his instigation, the Assembly of Panama had the so-called Parliament at the time, clearly a pure creature of Noriega's, had said that, you know, Panama was in a state of war with the United States. We'd had a U.S. Marine major shot and killed at a Panamanian Defense Force checkpoint. We'd had a couple of the other Marines who were with him beaten up and threats against others. And we also still were operating under the Panama Canal Treaty, where we had some obligations to, you know, maintain the safe operation of the canal for the international community. So we did not offer, you know, he's indicted, so we're going to get him defense. We had a lot of other legitimate, you know, arguments that we were operating, first of all, under, you know, Article 51 of the UN Charter in self-defense, since the Panamanians had said they were in state of war with us. We were defending and protecting American citizens who had been attacked. And we were defending the canal. Now, even with all that, the UN General Assembly found that we had violated Article 2 of the UN Charter and were engaged in aggression. What the reason we were successful in getting past that was we very quickly turned Panama over to the legally, you know, the opposition, which had legally won the elections that Noriega had essentially set aside earlier in the year. And Panama then went on to become a, you know, self-sufficient democracy. And so everybody forgot about, you know, whether it was or wasn't aggression. But I am, you know, troubled that they don't really have much of a legal justification here. And the precedent that we're setting for saying that if you have a bill of indictment in the United States against a foreign leader, you could just go in and get them. You know, I've seen a lot of debate on the internet about whether this will or whether it won't be, something that the Chinese and the Russians will take as an invitation to do this themselves. I take the point that it's not U.S. actions that lead Russia or China to act wantonly and without regard to international law. They do it all the time. I will say, however, the next time it's convenient for them, you know, they will be quite happy to point to this as a precedent.
Oh, I'm sure they will. Look, Panama, I think one of the keys to Panama, which you mentioned, but I would emphasize, is we left it much better off. We left it as a functioning democracy, which it was prepared to be. And what I want to talk about is, okay, well, what are the prospects in Venezuela? First, though, you know, I would just mention that the legal thing is a fig leaf, because if you look at what Trump and Hegseth and Stephen Miller immediately began doing is threatening Colombia, threatening Denmark. Well, we haven't indicted the prime minister of Denmark and even, you know, Petro, who's a terrible president.
And Mexico and Iran. I mean,
so it's that I think that's absolutely right. Here's the conundrum that there are a number of deeper problems here, though. And one of the ones that I want to hear your views on, and I'll lay out mine. It was plausible to think that, particularly with this very substantial American military presence, particularly relative to the size. So Panama, 2 million people, Venezuela, at least 28 million people. So it's well over an order of magnitude different. And Venezuela is a big country. I think it's also fair to say that what you have in Venezuela is a deeply institutionalized repressive system. You know, the intelligence apparatus, you have the military, of course, and you have the colectivos, which are about 220,000 militia, sort of like the Basij in Iran. So these are young men with guns who feel beholden to the regime.
And motorcycles.
And what I worry about is, look, my heart is completely with Machado and with Venezuelan Democrats. But I have two big concerns, and I touched a bit on these in an article I just had out in The Atlantic. One is, can you really expect them to be able to overcome all that? I just think it's very, very hard. Even if the United States said, okay, we'll only talk to Machado. Okay, what do you do about the police? What do you do about the military? What do you do about the colectivos? It's going to be very hard. The other thing is, I think you'll push back on this, but that's good. I've thought a lot about our mistakes in Iraq, which you and I have periodically discussed. You know, I vividly remember listening to Richard Perle bring in Ahmed Chalabi, Iraqi exile, but there are many other Iraqi exiles. Kanan Makia, for example, a very, very deeply thoughtful Iraqi writer, who were making the case that, look, Iraq is a largely secular society. It has functioning bureaucracies. It's well-educated. All of which was true when they left. But they had left in the 70s, in some cases the early 80s, and that society had been put through a Cuisinart. And so by the time we finally roll into that, including, by the way, the Cuisinart includes both the Iran-Iraq War and the first Gulf War and everything that followed after that. And I fear that something similar is true of Venezuela. I mean, we have lots of Venezuelan exiles who correctly point out that Venezuela had a functioning democracy. It was prosperous, very well educated. All true. But there's a part of me that wonders, well, what kind of society do we have left? And what is that society's path to self-governance? Now, I think we have to think about that. And I think we should be wrestling with that. And the U.S. government should do what it can do to help. But it does set some limits on how quickly a democratic government could be established, if the administration had any interest, which they don't, because Trump basically is in it for the oil.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there are a couple of questions that I think this, what you've just said, you know, kind of surfaces. One is, shouldn't they have thought all of this through and had a plan before they actually went in and grabbed off, you know, Maduro? Because, you know, obviously, yeah, what is the next step? The president has said, we are running, Venezuela now. because we've decapitated the government. So we are running it. I mean, that was true in Iraq because our war plan, 1003 Victor, actually was a, you know, decapitation war plan. It was to remove Saddam. And that meant because we had the military there, we were the occupying power. We had an obligation to provide for the successor, you know, government there. Now, you can make all sorts of arguments, if you would like, about how well or how poorly we did that. And then there's plenty, obviously, that we did that is, you know, subject to criticism. I don't gainsay any of that. But, you know, we had at least thought some things through. We had some plans. Some of them went awry. You know, the office, ORHA, the office that Jay Garner headed that was initially meant to kind of start the rehabilitation of Iraq sort of kind of fell flat. And then we had the CPA and Jerry Bremer and all of that. But there's none of that here. Somehow the theory of the case here seems to be that we are going to, quote, run Venezuela by remote control and threats. And the threat the president's made very explicit. If Delcy Rodriguez, the acting president, and by the way, Maduro's handpicked vice president before that, and a dyed-in-the-wool Chavista, by all accounts, father was a revolutionary terrorist, very beholden to Cuba, you know, that somehow the president says, if she doesn't deliver the goods, you know, what we want, she's going to be subject to something even worse than Maduro, which I don't know what that means because she's not under indictment. So does that mean that we're just going to kill her? I mean, you know, so that's point, you know, number one. And sort of the more sophisticated version of this, which Marco Rubio has put forward, is, well, we've had discussions with her. Some of them brokered through the Qataris who've vouched for her as sort of a capable technocrat. She kind of has, you know, distinguished herself by effectively, you know, taking over and running the petroleum sector of the economy relatively well, given the sanctions and the disrepair that PDVSA, the, you know, nationalized oil company, has allowed to, you know, develop over a 25-year period. Here's, I think, the problem with all this. She's not in control of the guys with the guns. You know, the interior minister or Padrino, the defense minister, you've got the secret police. And what worries me and what I'm fearful of is that by trying to do this by remote control, and by the way, I'm not saying that as a result, the, you know, alternative should be a massive U.S. occupation of Venezuela. I can't think of anything crazier than that. But the problem here is this is a very violent society. It has got one of the highest homicide rates in the hemisphere. I think it's only behind El Salvador and Honduras in terms of murders per capita. So you got a lot of people with guns. The colectivos, by the way, according to reports I saw this morning, have been out handing out weapons to, you know, people in the barrios in various cities. To try and, you know, kind of stimulate the masses to defend the regime if there are further assaults or attacks. You know, what seems to me, you don't have here what you had in Iraq, which is ethnic and religious cleavages that almost guaranteed, you know, that you could have a civil war, whether it was Sunni Shia, Arab Kurd. You don't have that here, but what you do have is a lot of interests that are heavily armed, and you've got potential wealth of the state, you know, at risk here. So the things that they've asked her to do, access to the, you know, oil industry for American firms on preferential terms, cutting off the bad guys that you, you know, cited earlier, Iran, Cuba, Hezbollah, et cetera, Russia, et cetera. I mean, not a good augury that when she was, you know, sworn in to take over, she went and hugged the Chinese and Russian and Iranian ambassadors that doesn't sound to me like someone who's about to break with those people. I mean, maybe that was just performative, which is what they keep saying. Whenever she does something that seems to contradict that she's going to be a willing tool of the new Yankee imperialists, that it's all performative for domestic purposes. Maybe that's what she was doing. But even if it is, you know, at some point, you know, Padrino and Sebelio, they're not going to, you know, break with these guys. They're not going to break with Cuba. Cuba, you know, keeps that place going, and they keep Cuba going. So I just don't see how this works in the long run. And it's, you know, it's right to be concerned because the security forces don't like Machado, and therefore you can't just put her in charge and expect that to be a happy ending either. I'm just worried that we're likely to see this thing blow up in their face and lead to the very opposite of what they, you know, purport to want, which is a stable hemisphere with less, you know, drugs and less migration. I think it's going to generate more of everything that they're purporting to want to control.
I agree with all that. I'd push some of it a little bit further. First, as soon as you said the Qataris are vouching for Delcy Rodriguez, that makes my blood run cold, you know. And the point about the men with the guns is critical. Part of the issue here is, first, it's clear to me that there's a lack of planning. I mean, even there was a fair amount of planning done before the Iraq War, and it was still a god-awful mess. You know, I have views of why that was the case, and I think actually the United States Army bears some of the blame for that. But here, I don't think there was any planning whatsoever. And it's very clear that Rubio and Trump are not entirely in the same place, don't have the same objectives. It's clear, furthermore, that there is a bigger play, and that is putting pressure on Cuba and bringing possibly trying to bring that regime down. So that there are some quite expansive objectives. The business about getting oil on preferential terms, so this is classic Trump. In fact, I believe he said the problem with George W. Bush is he didn't take Iraqi oil. He has the crudest kind of imperial views of these things. Well, if there is one thing that is going to be
like Lenin's caricature of you know, Western leaders before World War I.
But if there is one thing that is going to set Latin Americans off.
Of course.
Venezuelans in particular, is the idea that the Yankees come because they want to steal your oil, and they even say that they want to steal your oil. I know the oil companies are used to operating in really tough circumstances, but I have to think that they really would be under fire. There's one other point here in all that, really, I guess two other points. One is, I would expect that there will be pushback. That is to say, Cubans have taken real losses. It's clear the United States is going to put pressure on them by trying to turn off the oil spigot. That I think we can do, because we can stop tankers going from Venezuela to Cuba. Although when they're, who knows what will happen when they are Russian flagged, as recently happened.
Yeah. They're still tracking Nabella, I understand, but not clear what they're going to do when they find her.
And I think they have somehow convinced themselves, well, we're not going to be stupid like George W. Bush. We're not going to put 100,000 troops in. There are a lot of other ways for Venezuela or Cuba to push back. One is certainly terrorism. And whether it's directed against American citizens in countries like Mexico, and there are a lot of them there, or even in our own country, including using the drug cartels, we are very vulnerable to things like drone attacks and sporting events and I-95 when it has a traffic jam, or things that are even more sinister yet. I think it is not beyond the ability of these drug cartels to put together drone submersibles packed with high explosives that you could steer into a cruise ship or something like that. So I think there are a lot of ways in which they could push back. And because we don't admit to ourselves that we've done a warlike thing, and because we don't talk about the people we've killed, we tend not to expect it. Last point that I would make is, in all the ways that this can go south, terrorism, all that sort of stuff, it's embarrassing. one of the biggest could be major refugee flows. If you really create a lot of chaos, there you could get big refugee flows. A lot of people around the world, Chinese and Russians in particular, but frankly, at this point, the Danes would be delighted to see that happen, to teach us a lesson.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Big color, bigger savings. Sherwin-Williams Super Sale is here. Get 40% off paints and stains June 5th through the 11th with prices starting at $30.89. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
Yeah. I mean, but the kind of magical thinking that is going on, you know, in the administration, I mean, just before we came on, I saw that DHS is saying to, you know, all the Venezuelans who come under the various TPS rulings in 2021 and 2023, you know, go home. We got rid of Maduro. Go home. As if, you know, the fact that we snatched this one guy and is still in the hands of the same, you know, horrific people who've been running the place to begin with is enough to make people go home. It's like insane. Who thinks they're going to go home? I have a question for you, Elliot. And you kind of raised this. So in Iraq, and both of us were involved both before and during the war in Iraq, the United States, for all of the accusations, was not motivated to go into Iraq to seize the oil. I mean, again, that's one of Trump's big complaints, is how stupid we were. We didn't take the oil. But worldwide, millions of people in the streets demonstrating no blood for oil. We now have the president of the United States stand up in Mar-a-Lago and give a press conference saying, we're doing this to take the oil. We want the oil. And I have not seen any giant demonstrations, you know, anywhere in the United States or anywhere else saying, you know, no blood for oil. What am I missing something? What's going on with the left?
Well, they're too busy celebrating Zoran Mamdani establishing a major socialist beachhead in New York City, of all places, I suspect. I think there are probably a couple of things at work. One of them, And this does get to the appeal of the commando raid or the short bombing campaign as a military tool. They're quick. It seems like a sort of a scalpel. It's over fast. And so, you know, there wasn't a big reaction when Clinton ordered the bombing of Iraq. I think it was 98, Operation Desert Fox. But there is something about thousands of foreign soldiers sweeping into a country that I think elicits a lot of pushback. I do suspect if we had launched an invasion of Venezuela, no matter how welcome it might have been, and I'm not entirely certain on that one, with tens and tens of thousands of American troops streaming into Maracaibo and Caracas, I bet you'd be seeing some of those demonstrations. That's one thing. Secondly, for a variety of reasons, I don't think the Russians or the Chinese want to feed that right now. That might very well change. Thirdly, it seems to me that part of Trump's perverse genius is he has desensitized people, not just in the United States, but around the world, to very bad behavior. And they just sort of expected of him. I don't know. What's your explanation?
No, I think those are about as good an explanation as I've heard, honestly. I don't really have a, a good one. I think you've really well covered it. I mean, you know, there's another element we haven't talked about yet, which we should have probably talked about when we were talking about the legality of all this, which is the relationship between the executive branch and the Congress when it comes to the use of military force. Because this was just not notified to anybody. Now, Marco Rubio has sort of tried to provide a kind of, again, a fig leaf here by saying, well, it's a law enforcement operation and we never notify those. So we didn't have to notify anybody. And oh, by the way, Congress leaks and, you know, we didn't have to notify them. You know, one wonders what, you know, Marco Rubio, what Senator Marco Rubio would have thought of those arguments when he was a sitting member of the Senate, had he been treated that way. But I digress. I mean, it's to me, it's just unimaginable that you would have a military operation of this complexity and importance that, I mean, look, the New York Times and the Washington Post found out about it before the fact and didn't publish in deference to the traditional norms. I don't think anyone in the Gang of Eight would have leaked this had they been briefed, in given my experience with The Hill and briefing them on things like this. Unconscionable that they would do this. I mean, this was a huge operation involving 150 aircraft, lots of different, you know, space and unmanned air assets, naval assets, a lot of rotary wing assets. I mean, it could have involved it went extremely well. I mean, it went as well as this could possibly have gone. I think before we start giving out, you know, a lot of medals yet, I do want to find out a little bit more about the inside help that they may or may not have had in having this. I mean, there've been stories about CIA having a source inside who gave them information. I've seen a lot of speculation that it was Delcy Rodriguez. I don't believe that, by the way. I think that's extremely unlikely. It is more likely that it was some low-level person who'd been recruited. I mean, who knows? But the possibility exists that there was, you know, at least some element of the regime that was complicit in this, which, you know, diminishes to some degree the operational level of success. That doesn't negate it, but it does.
Yeah. I mean, I guess my feeling is that this is very impressive.
Yeah, no. I'm not taking anything away. I'm just saying it may be less impressive than it looks right now, but it was impressive under any circumstance.
It's at least as impressive as the Bin Laden raid.
I would say more.
It's more so. Here's, by the way, just one thing on that, and then I want to go to your main point, which is about Congress. You notice that they staged a photo which is parallel to the Obama photo of everybody looking at a computer screen during the raid. They did one of those at Mar-a-Lago, except Pete Hegseth is standing tall and looking good.
I'm sure he applied his makeup just before the picture was taken.
I'm sure he did. And the thing that struck me about it is this is now part of the theater of the use of military force. There's not a damn thing that they could have done
right
to affect the raid at that point. Same way, there's not a thing that Obama and his people could have done.
Right.
And this there's a kind of a pathology here about the use of force. On the question of authorizing, first of notifying the Gang of Eight, that is to say the chairman and ranking member of the key committees in Congress. Speaker and the Minority Leader and the
Senate Majority Leader and Minority Senate Leader.
Yeah. This is this is part of a pattern of how they treat Congress. And let's face it, we have a Congress that is composed, certainly on the Republican side, chiefly of geldings who are not going to complain about anything. But I think the larger issue here, particularly if this turns into a more extended use of force, is that the Trump administration, in this case as in others, has followed the pattern of other administrations, particularly Democratic, but not just Democratic administrations, in basically exerting the right to wage war without any kind of authorization from Congress. One of the points I'm making in another piece that I'm writing is George W. Bush, to his credit, got an AUMF, an authorization for the use of military force for Afghanistan and for Iraq, with some reservations on the part of members of the administration, as his father did for the first Gulf War. However, Bill Clinton did not do that over Bosnia. He did not do that over Kosovo. And Barack Obama did not do that over Libya, where, you know, I think we had, 150 Tomahawk strikes and lots of sorties. And again, we're killing lots of people. And it's one of the larger questions, which I hope will eventually get addressed as we exit this awful period in our history, hopefully in at least 3 years' time, but who knows, maybe even earlier, is how should we limit the power of the presidency to do a whole bunch of things? And one of them should be to carry this country into war without some kind of congressional go-ahead, or at least a congressional veto. Lots of people had problems with the War Powers Act of 1973, which has really fallen into disuse. But I think that's a large and enduring issue. And I hope your best hope would be if you had a principled president who acknowledged that, yeah, there's something problematic here, and I'm willing to accept some constraints on the ability of future presidents to simply throw American military power around the world whenever and however he wants to. I have a feeling we're going to be continuing to talk about Venezuela for a long time, Eric, as we both agree, this one isn't going away anytime soon.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Yeah, I one more question I wanted to get your thoughts on, because you've written a little bit about it before we close out, which is the likely international sort of aftershocks here. You know, how, and you know, the, as you put it in your Atlantic piece, what's the larger context here of other, you know, authoritarian regimes? I mean, you make some very important points in your article about it's tougher to take down authoritarian regimes than it used to be, in part because the apparatus of repression has become more sophisticated, and the technology that is available to them for surveillance and reprisal against citizens is greater. I mean, we've got, you know, there's a lot going on in the world. Iran has erupted into one of its seemingly every 2 or 3 year paroxysms of protest against the regime, which was, I think, predictable. In fact, I think I predicted it after the 12-day war. There's a lot of, you know, stuff going on elsewhere in the world. How do you see this kind of affecting, you know, other actors? And one corollary of that, which you also have spoken about, you know, the use of military force, you know, particularly for, as you put it, these kind of short, sharp, interventions, can become kind of addictive. And as you pointed out, the president, you know, in the 72 hours since Saturday, has managed to threaten, I think, military action against 5 or 6 different countries, including NATO allies. Is he getting to appropriate or misappropriate a phrase from Stalin, dizzy with success? You know, is there a danger that these guys are getting really drunk with power? I'm thinking about the unhinged performance of Stephen Miller on CNN yesterday with Jake Tapper, in which he said, you know, he gave his version of the Melian dialogue from Thucydides about the strong doing what they will and the weak suffering what they must. And that's the way of the world. I mean, that's not how Americans have traditionally conducted themselves or purported to conduct themselves around the world.
Right. Well, and part of, you know, for those who took courses on Thucydides with us, know that part of the story of the Melian dialogue, even though things end badly for the Melians, they also end badly for the Athenians. And this is part of their decay. So on, let me talk first about regions and then about Trump himself. So first, I think lots of different reactions. I think in Latin America, one of the things that's interesting is you have some right-wing governments that are happy about this. The Milei government in Argentina. In other cases, people are appalled. And obviously, Colombia, the Petro government is hostile, but there are some major political figures in Colombia who are cheering this on because they have a very, very dark view of the Venezuelan regime, which helped sponsor and host the FARC. So I think it'll be mixed.
It's like you host the ELN today.
And right. Well, and of course, Petro was ELN, which is another terrorist group there, less well known than the FARC. China and Russia, I agree with you. I think the idea that this will somehow make it easier for them to do terrible things, they would do terrible things if they thought it was in their interest and in their capacity. It'll give them a propaganda line. With Europe, I think I don't think it matters unless this menacing talk about Greenland continues. If it does, then there I think it does matter. The interesting question, which I talk about a bit in the article, is I think Maduro in Venezuela is one of a number of decaying dictatorships. And you and I have talked about trying to get Steve Kotkin on, who's thought about this. Maduro had been in power for a while. Before that, you had Chavez. He ruined the country. It's an economic wreck, but you have a strong repressive apparatus. Iran, same story. It's an economic wreck, but you have a very strong repressive apparatus. The ideology has kind of faded in those places. Russia, I think, is the same thing. There isn't really an ideology that's carrying them forward other than sort of brute nationalism. There have even been one or two Chinese writers who have sort of taken the view that this is something of a warning for Xi, not because of American intervention, but about what happens to a late stage dictatorship. And I think here's my assessment of it. Because the technique of repression has gotten to be so much better, because it's internationalized, you can have Cuban or Chinese or Russian or Iranian advisors and technology, you can suppress popular dissent and you can control your own military for much longer than would have been the case in the past. But that means when the explosion comes, it's going to be huge and uncontrollable. And as I was saying earlier, the society will have been put through a Cuisinart. So it's going to be much more messy. But what we also see is that these regimes are fragile. And in the piece I quote, I mentioned the Prigozhin revolt, where you know, Putin's caterer with a few thousand mercenaries rattles the whole regime. So I think it's one more source of uncertainty in the world. It's going to lead the dictators to be more repressive, and I think it'll help set the conditions for more explosive social reactions. On Trump, this is exactly the piece I'm writing right now. I think they are intoxicated by success. Trump has had a terrific run using military power, killing Soleimani, pummeling the Houthis, Midnight Hammer, the Iran raid, which you and I both, look, we approved of the killing of Soleimani, the raids on the Houthis, Midnight Hammer, we all were in favor of those. And the two of us, I think, were reasonably successful as these things go and important to do.
Maybe not so much with the Houthis, where the cost exchange ratio was pretty high for what we got.
I mean, but they've stopped doing some of the things we didn't want them to do. So that you have that. So he's actually been on a roll. And
I think that had more to do with the Israelis than us, but never mind.
Well, yeah, but it's true, but not relevant. I mean, the point is what Trump thinks. And it's not as though Pete Hegseth is George C. Marshall or let alone Bob Gates. Or Dick Cheney. saying, hang on, young fella. I mean, Pete Hegseth plays to his worst instincts. And of course, Trump is this narcissist and all that. So I think, I mean, he's a cunning enough politician that he'll pull himself back from the brink most of the time. But the fundamental problem with the use of military force is it's always unpredictable. And I don't care what scale you're talking about. I don't care if we're the United States of America operating against Grenada. There's going to be something unpredictable about this. And at some point,
it's nonlinear.
Trump, it's nonlinear, and Trump will run out of luck.
All right. Final question. So if this goes south, like, who takes the blame here? Does Rubio become the scapegoat? Is that why J.D. Vance has been like so invisible in all of this?
Well, I think Rubio takes the blame. It's been wonderful to watch J.D. Vance squirm, because he has to explain Midnight Hammer. He has to explain bombing the Houthis. He has to explain this thing to his isolationist base. And he himself is, I think, to the extent he has any principles at all, which is a debatable subject. I think he is sort of an isolationist, so he squirms. But I think for Rubio, this is high stakes. I think if it works out well, in some ways, he's very well positioned. Vance isn't present in any of this. If it works out poorly, he is indeed the goat. But I'm not sure that redounds to Vance's credit. Vance wasn't present at the press conference, as far as I can tell, and he's not playing much of a role. And the two things that I think here, I guess my bottom line of Rubio, this is an extremely cunning politician. Look, he went from being one of Trump's major opponents to being his loyal lieutenant.
Lackey, even one might say.
Even lackey. He had a meteoric rise in Florida politics and in the Senate. He also has a track record of betraying any benefactor when it's in his interest. Ask Jeb Bush if you don't believe me. And so I think he has said, yes, it's J.D. Vance in 28, but if Vance stumbles and this turns out successfully, which it very well may, and somewhere you and I can't foresee, he will happily walk right over Vance's corpse. Don't you agree?
Yeah, pretty much. I don't. I mean, I don't think the odds of this being completely successful are very high.
True.
But so I'm more kind of interested in the downside for Marco than the upside.
And I give him credit, because I think he does. His principles are flexible, but he
had, kind way to, that's a very generous way to put it.
Very flexible. But he has some, and they're kind of the ones that you and I would agree with, I think.
Yes and no.
I don't want to push that.
No, yes and no. I mean, I think I'd put more of an emphasis on the flexibility. And yes, there are sort of, you can see some in some reptilian part of his brain, there is, you know, still some kind of neocon reflexes that are, you know, lurking in there. But I wouldn't put principle as a big element there.
Principle is not the biggest, you know, advertising point of this administration anyway.
Yeah. Well, you know, we're going to have this issue with us for a while, as well as all the others that we've neglected and how we'll have to come back to in our next regularly scheduled episode of Shield of the Republic. But we'll come back to this and see how our at least first blush reactions track against the unfolding reality. Thanks for making the time to come back to this, Elliot.
Looking forward to it.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.